All right, so just let me place us where we are, in a sense, overall. Your podcasts will be, Becca, would you describe where the podcast will be as of tonight?
Well, you all know exactly where your podcast will be because that's where you've put them, which is on the Cyber One podcast blog. That's true for all the law students and all of the extension school students. So I hope that you enjoy looking through and listening to some of the podcasts of your fellow students from this class and the other one.
But you were saying something about what you've done in Second Life. I know it might be of interest.
Oh, yeah. So we're also setting it up so that we can listen to the podcasts from Berkman Island in Second Life. I just set up an MP3 player, which normally just would play songs from wherever on the web, but it's actually going to be set up to play our podcasts in various different playlists, and it's going to take me a few more hours to get it totally set up. But this week, the Extension School students are going to be listening to some of the podcasts that they've made and talking about them, and you guys are certainly all welcome to come in and listen to your podcasts in the world, and if you're interested, to host a discussion with some at-large participants about your particular topic issue.
Good. And so this week we're actually broaching into video. And Deborah is here, in a sense, to lead us off. And Dean will be our resource tomorrow. And I'm very interested in us thinking about how we deal with the product that we've produced. Because part of the task in distributed forms of production is figuring out some method of aggregating so that the interesting stuff somehow floats to the top without stifling the creativity that goes into improving things as you go along. And I am thinking, at least myself, about that in design terms. That is, how can we do it? We are ourselves trying to design an environment that does that for ourselves, just as one might think of doing it for CCTV. And it's in that sense, although I don't think this is necessarily the way Deborah thinks about it, but it was in that sense that I first was triggered by what it was that she's done, because she has organized a process and overseen a process and brought it along to a point where she has taken the aggregated work of a distributed body of people and put it together into something quite extraordinary. So, Deborah, you want to say a word or two in introduction and then just...
Sure. First, I'd like to say thank you both for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here, and hi, everybody. 2.5 years ago, I got a phone call with an offer to embed with the New Hampshire National Guard as they were deploying to Iraq. My idea instead was to give the soldiers cameras and to work with them over the internet to tell the story through their eyes. As a filmmaker, what I was most intrigued with was to crawl inside the experience of war to know what it looked like, smelled like, felt like from their perspective, not from what I thought war was. So what I wanted to do was to tell a story from the inside out versus from my perspective, you know, the outside in. I picked one company to work with, which is Charlie Company, 3rd of the 172nd. They're a mountain infantry unit. For those of you military history buffs, you'll know that infantry's objective is to seize the last 200 yards to engage the enemy. So I picked them because I knew that they would most likely see a lot of action. And number two, they were going to be at LSA Anaconda in Balad, and I knew they would have internet access. What I was interested in was setting up and working with them through a permeable relationship, where I would talk with them, where I could understand what it was, and then use my skills as a filmmaker to make sure that we would translate that story into what you get to see. So it wasn't just giving cameras to a bunch of guys and then getting the video when they came home. This was a process. Tapes, on average, took 2 weeks to get from Iraq to me. Before they left, I spent 6 days with them, 3 times down at Fort Dix, you know, building trust, getting my share of hazing, and giving some back. Basically, it's about building a relationship. Nobody's going to, at the bottom of any storyteller, basically, it's going to, can I swear in this class?
Yes, you may.
Okay. Just checking. I went to Brown. You know, we swear there.
The 17 words are honored in this class.
All right. Well, basically, the bottom line was, why should we trust you with our story? You know, who the fuck are you? What do you know? And why should we spend our time with you? Right? In order to get that trust, to get someone's story, if that's truly what you want, if you're merely looking for video or something to support your own point of view, maybe you can get that. But if you really want someone to open up with you, you've got to spend the time, and you've got to be willing to be vulnerable back to them. So in the end, the caveat for my access was that I had to get soldiers to volunteer. So I stepped out in front of 180 men, because there's no women in infantry. I told the guys my vision. I got a hailstorm of questions. In the end, 10 soldiers stepped forward to take cameras and agreed to work with me. 5 of them filmed all year. In total, 21 soldiers came to the project and filmed. The film, in the end, follows 3 soldiers. They have diverse points of view, plus a wife and a mother and a girlfriend that they left behind, because for me, the home front was an important aspect to tell. So the film spans there before their deployment, a year there, and 10 months after they come home. I'm picking apart to show you for a few reasons. One is this is after they've been there for a good 10 months, they're there. But notice different things, like the fact that this shot, their two most popular mounts were the dashboard of the Humvee, which is what this is, or the gun turret. I also had POV cameras that they could mount on their Kevlar, and I had a thermal imaging camera that they could use as well. But subtle things as far as when you're trying to tell a story, like the fact that most films in a war zone, if you're working with a filmmaker and a crew, you're in the back seat, so already you're one behind. I like subtle things like the fact that these small cameras, I had no specific mics except when they were doing interviews because I wanted you to feel right there. So there's all different sort of subtleties. I don't know how much detail of that you all are interested in. I'm happy to talk about it with you after. So this is, I guess, we'll show about 10 minutes and then we'll talk some more, okay? Yeah. Is there audio more than this, I hope? And I guess while we're figuring that, the one other point that I would say is, for me, I think truth doesn't reside in just one main narrative. I think, and everybody's always chasing after truth. What is truth? Yes. Perfect. For me, with this style of filmmaking, what I'm aiming to do is to get multiple ground-level narratives that are contrasting narratives, different points of view, with the hope that then it illuminates more of what the experience is.
Mounting with weapons, and needless to say, the insurgency doesn't like that.
Working with the Iraqi police guys, part of the strategic approach that's set by President Bush is kind of shift the burden of running the country, protecting it, to the Iraqis. The faster we train, the better for the overall mission, and the sooner we can all go home.
Let me take off this vest because
I can't do it.
It's
magic.
No,
we can't. He's not going to say, hey, Sakali, you wait, I take my vest off, then I shoot you. Serious.
Elbows in. Shake the bus up.
So,
hey, ADD, look at me, motherfucker.
Subal. Hi, Nana, so much. Subal, hi, Nana, time. Which is the water? Son, Nana.
Breathe. Not a baby.
Squeeze.
I don't give a shit.
He's not having a baby.
Yes.
Bossy, look.
Not Angeles. Michael, yes. Have you dig the house?
It was the deadliest insurgent attack in a wave of violence that swept across Iraq today. A suicide bomber killed at least 16 Iraqi policemen at a station near a U.S. Marine base in Baghdad in western Iraq.
Many dead in Baghdad.
Including 10 U.S. soldiers. That 10 dead or 10 injured. Uh-huh. But we hit the milestone of 1,000 dead.
Do I think we're making progress? No, I don't know. I think any country should be allowed to have its own civil war without people getting in the way. But I also believe that there are some pretty dangerous people in Iraq.
I want to see this fight. Let's get a look at the contenders before we go in there.
In this corner.
Look at him there. Oh, yeah. He's ready. And who's this guy?
That's Fred.
Fred? Yeah, that's your keep the lights on. Bang. Oh, boy. Who's your money on?
All that sounded like a spider was pretty fucking quick.
This is gonna be a battle. Oh, shit!
Well, the last scorpion died when the spider bit it in the face.
What are they waiting on then? Attack. Yeah! Oh, shit! Yeah! Oh! Oh, I need true blood. Where's the blade?
The spider.
Oh, jeez! This is great.
There we go.
So now he gets the tank, right, Warren?
Yep. He's like, yeah, he's my bitch now.
Just goes to show you there's always a bigger badass.
A bunch of white guys in New Hampshire, and literally, besides one or two guys, everybody else thinks the same way. That's not an accident or coincidence. That's just a group think taking effect. You know? I think five guys out of the whole company did not vote for Bush, and they probably kept it low.
If you're a guy, the old Bush macho let's kick ass thing sounds pretty good.
Alright, we're back here at the cache for the second time tonight. Hellman got hit with the IED. We got facial injuries here.
Let's go.
The blast knocked me into the trunk. When I did become alert, the first thought in my head, I could feel the blood running down my face.
One person in here and I need a stretcher.
How fucked up am I, you know what I mean? How bad are these wounds? You know, really couldn't tell. The thoughts started becoming just more angry and pissed off that I got hit. And, you know, 9 out of 10 times, most ambush-type incidents are IEDs, and you can't do shit about it. There's no way to defend it.
I can't be alive after all these guys. All right, This is a depressing place to be. This is the equipment graveyard here at Anaconda. Every one of these pieces of equipment that's damaged has a story behind it, and you can imagine the story. That was someone's father or someone's mother. That was somebody's son or daughter.
support George Bush or anything, but for him to say that major combat operations are over kind of conflicts with what we're seeing and dealing with every day.
Downtown, Die Hard City. Thousands of U.S. and Iraqi troops are steeling themselves to a possible route assault on the stronghold of Fallujah. As heavily outnumbered resistance gunmen vow to fight to the death, analysts fear this could be Iraq's Alamo.
All right, today is Thursday, November 18th, 10 in the morning. First platoon has been assigned MSR patrol in Fallujah.
This terrain all around us. Just look at this madness. What's that forbidden zone from the original Planet of the Apes? Oh, we're in the wrong area, huh? All the action's taking place somewhere else. Every time you hear a boom, somebody's going to heaven.
Hey, Master, kind of face due west a little more. Your ass crack is right in my face. I think that's more of a threat to my health and mental well-being. Point your weapon at Fallujah.
Can we build a wall around the country and leave?
Wall? Just leave it alone and leave. Fuck the oil, man. Fuck that. Not worth it. I'll walk everywhere in the U.S. I'll recycle everything, damn it. I'll even drive a Honda Insight. Little hybrid thingies.
Fuck that.
See, look here, you're the reason why we always go to war with Bauer. You and your little Ford F-1000s. Redneck, fuck.
I can't haul anything with a Honda inside.
How often you gotta throw all 16 bags of fucking Budweiser cans? Everybody wants safety, right? Ooh, my kids, I want them safe, so they buy more SUVs. Well, then the people without SUVs say, holy shit, if I get hit by an SUV, my kids are gonna be crushed. So I want safety, so I'm gonna buy an SUV.
I don't know if you're worried about safety.
Oh, everybody's worried about safety.
Someone's out of a full-size truck with a frame. I'm not scared.
In fact, we're so worried about safety, that's why we're here. Make sure we have safety in the U.S.
Okay, so we're here in the city of Fallujah. There's not much left of this place. And stuff's going boom. Marine's probably shooting at something. You know, I'm sure a lot of guys lost their lives here. So I kind of feel a little guilty coming in here and taking pictures. Did anybody clear those rooms yet? Okay. Going forward!
November 29th, Sergeant Smith of 1st Squad got shot in the leg. The round entered his calf and blew out the front of his shin, shattering the bone, exposing to flesh and fat and muscle like hot pizza cheese sliding from the slice. Our patrol ship came on, and we were immediately sent out to the area where the firefight occurred. Our job was to keep an eye on the bodies until the toe taggers showed up.
Yeah, this is where the guy got cut in half with a 50 cal.
Oh, it was quick.
Not really. He got shot in the legs.
For 9 months, I had never seen these guys face to face. I mean, I heard the bullets crack over my head. I've seen the IEDs and the mortars and the V-bids and all that go off.
Hey, look, he dropped his AK rounds.
I felt, you know, proud for the job that the guys in First Squad did. I felt jealous that it wasn't us. We weren't able to get those guys and kill them. I decided that I needed to film these guys. I scanned the bodies with the camera and had a few choice words for them. They basically said, you know, it was I'm glad they're dead. That's one less guy that we've got that's going to fire an RPG at a Humvee, you know. So I handed the tapes. Someone said the first sergeant was visually upset or physically upset or something. I don't know. Maybe that means his stomach got sick or something. I'm not sure. But it was deemed inappropriate footage, probably because of my commentary while filming, you know. But I mean, if we're trained to shoot our weapons and kill these guys, how do you expect us to talk? What do you want me to say? You know, oh, geez, I'm sorry, you, I don't know. At one point, a dog came along, and there was, like, human flesh kind of around the body, and the dog, you know, picked up some flesh and started eating. And I didn't see a problem with it, and neither did any of the guys we were with. You know? I didn't care about that. And I guess after the fact, you know, the command wanted me to shoot the dog or do something like that. But I'm sorry, we never got briefed on shooting a dog or what to do about that. And at the same rate, I don't care what the dog's eating, you know? Good for him. I hope he fills his belly.
We need to get everything ready because we need to go. You looking at your cool doll, Matthew?
So my hope here is that you will just open up with Deborah. There's just a ton of questions, and it just seems fascinating to me. So I hope you'll just let the questions flow.
Deborah's game for all kind of questions, too, I think. Is that fair to say?
Fair to say.
Here. Somehow we're going to get mics around here. We're starting this out and go around.
What's the response been that you've had from soldiers?
What's been the response from soldiers?
By
and large, incredibly favorable. Some, for me personally, some of the most gratifying responses have been from guys who, there's a scene in the film which you don't see where they hit and kill a Iraqi woman, a civilian, by accident. And it's quite common in Iraq. And I've had a few guys come up and say that, you know, they did that and they haven't known how to tell their family, but they're going to bring them to see the film and then they can maybe begin a conversation that they did that too.
Can you talk up a little bit?
Sure.
We got the buzz in the room.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, soldiers, and these guys, I don't know how many of you know the military, but these are all enlisted guys, so they're what you would call Joes plus non-commissioned officers, so they're specialists and sergeants and staff sergeants. These are the guys who are locking and loading and leaving the wire. These are the guys who are, in effect, fighting the war, because most officers and a lot of the LTs these days are having to stay in the TOC, in the Tactical Operations Center, on base. These are the guys that have to leave the wire every day. This is locking and loading. And for me, when I made my decision of who I was going to give cameras to, I wanted to give it to those guys. Because very often, you know, in the media, you see the officer and, you know, you sort of see like three guys in the background. And you can just tell. Some probably reporter said, hey, can you get a few guys to fill in the back of that frame? You know, and for me, I always wanted to hear their stories.
military itself been very cooperative with you? Have they released all the footage, or have they insisted on seeing it before you get it?
The way the access was, the tapes got turned into their company commander, and they had the option to review it, and it went to the public affairs officer, and then they were hand-delivered to me. There is one tape, which we deal with in the film, after Fallujah, but we got the stills, and Steve tells the story, so I didn't really have an issue with it as far as them keeping that tape.
One thing that I wanted to ask about is, I noticed in part of it you're using some music in the scene when they're driving through, and that surprised me because it struck me as kind of different from the aesthetic of the rest of what we saw, which is kind of just, you know, very raw, I mean, definitely edited by content footage, but it seemed kind of, there was more, I guess, director, like evident director involvement. I was just curious about your decision to use that.
There's a soundtrack. There is a soundtrack. To tell the story. I mean, it's a muted soundtrack, but it's there.
Can you say more about what your thinking was in your putting together the soundtrack, or why you chose to have it?
Because for me, it's about telling a story, and anything is constructed unless you're just watching a raw tape. There are 800 hours from Iraq, 200 hours stateside, that ended up making a 97-minute film. And when I set out to tell a story, I'm going to tell it however I best think it is told. So while there's certainly not violins playing, you know, when they hit and tragically kill someone or something like that, I don't go that far. But yeah, that the music that you saw was a bridge transition. You go back and those are face shots of the three main characters. It's sort of a place, actually, where the audience can kind of breathe and remind that this is the three that they're following and go back. So it is a construct, but any film is constructed.
What was your personal opinion on the war before you went and did this, and how do you think that impacted the footage that you chose to use, the people who you chose to give cameras to?
I'll start that. I didn't pick who to give cameras to. The caveat for the access was the soldiers self-selected, which is a very important fact to me. I didn't cast Zach, who happened to be raised a Shiite Muslim fluent in Arabic. He was one who stepped forward. And I think that maintains some integrity in the process. As far as my political views, I don't discuss them as far as in relation to the film. I haven't all along, and I won't. I mean, I understand them. I will with friends, and I certainly have them. But it's very important to me because I'm here speaking as Deborah Scranton, director of the war tapes. I'm not here speaking as, you know, a friend of a friend that you meet somewhere out at dinner who is happy to chew the fat over some of those issues. For me, my motivating factor was to tell the soldiers, who very often don't get a chance to tell their story. There are three characters in this. Mike Moriarty is pro-Bush, Hua, believes in the mission, enlisted after 9/11. Zach, who you got to hear a little bit about, reads The Nation, and definitely he's a student at UNH, and goes on record saying he voted for Kerry. Steve Pink is middle of the road. He basically rails against injustice of all forms. So there are three very diverse points of view. That's who you meet. And it's their views that I want you to hear, not my views.
How much did you plan in advance the sort of points you wanted to make or the issues you wanted to address before you started doing the filming?
I had none. Because the whole idea was to tell the story from their eyes, from the inside out. I had no way of knowing what was going to happen. I mean, when they got there, it was pretty quiet. They arrived in March. And for those of you who remember, it was in April when they hung the contractors' bodies from the bridge in Fallujah when all hell broke loose. So I had no idea. You know, when they set off, it was cooling down. It wasn't supposed to be that hot. They got there and all hell broke loose. I mean, I had no way of knowing. They could have gone and not had anything. But it turned out being that as a unit, they had over 250 direct enemy engagements. They saw a lot of action.
It seems to me that you're voicing two kind of contradictory approaches. Because on the one hand, you say that you're just presenting the views of the soldiers and you won't discuss your own personal views and you didn't plan out the issues. But on the other, you mentioned there's 800 hours of footage. You've selected these three individuals out of however many had the cameras and sort of structured the story in this way. And it seems impossible that that would not reflect some sort of preconceived views about what the true story is, that it's represented best by these three people.
The true story is what it means to be a soldier on the ground in Iraq for these guys. That was the story that I wanted to tell.
What I'm asking is, why are these three vehicles?
Because five filmed the whole year, and of those five, we picked the three, because those were the three that went the deepest as far as the story goes, and plus it was their family members, because we follow a wife, a mother, and a girlfriend, and their families let us in the most. I mean, when you're making a film or for theatrical release, because this is at the Tribeca Film Festival, you know, we're in theaters, and played at Kendall Square a couple weeks, you're looking for a narrative. You're looking to tell a story. So we picked the three out of the five that went as deep. And they represented a range of experience.
Yeah, I was very surprised when I saw the whole movie with the testimonies of the families, because they were really intimate. And I was wondering, how did you build that relationship? I mean, were you with them all the time, or they also had a camera? I mean, they were telling, like, really intimate stories.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time with the families. That was part of the 200 hours. Like I said, I spent time with the soldiers before they left home on leave and for 10 months after they came home. But the whole time I was with the families. And, yeah, I mean, they have family potlucks. I went to every family potluck. I brought my 6-year-old. My 6-year-old's the same age as Matt Moriarty. They played together. Yeah, it's trust and relationship and letting people know that you don't have an agenda. I mean, I understand what you're saying about it seeming contradictory, and to a degree it probably is. But I've tried to leave as few footprints as is possible and still make a film that tells a story.
Thanks. Can you describe what the process was like when you went down there? You went to Fort Bragg, did you say?
Fort Dix.
Fort Dix, and you were there for 6 days. Can you just describe what you did to sort of... because I trust that you were trying to be unbiased, but you just don't look conservative. Like, you look like a filmmaker, and so it's sort of...
Actually, the most important thing was I was a woman. That's what that's what came out.
Can you describe that, sort of what you did to win them over?
I went down 3 times, so it was for a couple days each time. And I, like I said, I hopped out in front of the 180 guys. And, yeah, I mean, I got a hailstorm of questions, which was, you know, why should we trust you? You know, Mike Moriarty was probably one of my toughest questioners. He's like, you know, what the fuck do you know about the National Guard? And I started my answer, which was a 13-minute answer, starting with the 1607 Massachusetts Bay Colony Pequot Wars. I mean, I had done my research. I knew my military history. I knew there were 9 units in New Hampshire. I knew what they stood for. You know, that's number one when you're trying to build respect. You have to know who you're trying to engage and talk with. And I let them grill me. I mean, my own personal background, I used to be on the U.S. ski team. I was a downhiller. You know, I went out on lanes training with them. We spent a lot of time. I heard a lot of bad jokes. You know, I got tested a bunch, but I worked network sports for years, so it takes a lot to really raise too much of an eyebrow for me. Plus, I really, truly wanted to tell the story. So I think my experience in telling stories is people will sniff you out. And if you go and you say, oh, I really want to tell your story, when you really... want to tell your story or you have a different idea, they'll figure it out. And by in general, soldiers are pretty like other groups of people. You know, they can be tribal. So they don't let you in easy. But you have to, for me, I can only share my experience. Going in, being honest in my motivation and just basically standing there and not changing, you win some of them over. But I mean, I didn't win all of them over. You know, only 10 of them took cameras. I would have given more. But over time, 21 ended up coming and filming. But 5 stopped filming because they just got sick of it. They didn't want to do it. So,
Hi.
Thanks.
Did you?
I like the wave. That was good.
Johnny Friendly.
Like that.
Yeah. So, since I think one of the things that we're establishing here is that you obviously really do feel passionate about trying to present a sort of neutral, unbiased point of view, or rather your own, stay unbiased and let the soldiers speak for themselves. Did you consider at any point, or did you allow them any involvement in the editing process? Since it seems like that, what we're establishing is that's the place where, even if you don't mean to, your own voice might creep in.
Yeah, so. No, they didn't get an input in the editing process. We showed it to them, and we said, we showed it as a work in progress, and said, you guys can each comment on how you yourself are represented, because they don't necessarily agree with each other. So they would start saying, I don't like how so-and-so is saying this. But you're like, uh-uh. you can comment on how you're represented. Do you feel that you're accurately being represented, that you are coming across in a way that you're comfortable with as a representation of yourself? And they all did. So for me, that was what it was, what I wanted to do.
So are you saying they all felt comfortable the first time you showed it, or that they made comments and you made changes according to what they wanted?
We didn't make any changes based on what they had said.
So what kinds of things did they say they were uncomfortable with?
Zach said he thought his nose was big.
That was like the biggest part of it. It was like
he hates. There's a part in there which he's very a little shy of his mother. His mother is Lebanese and is a wonderfully warm, incredible. I mean, I'm a mom, so I mean, for me, she's like a mom, you know. And she tells a remark where she says Zaher, which is his name. It means a flower, like a flower blooms in the springtime, which he hates. The fact that Mr. Tough Soldier Dude, his mother, is telling the world that he's named for the blooming of a flower. That was what he wanted me to take out, which I didn't. Quite a few girls like that comment, and he's single, so I think in the end it's okay.
I'm curious if you could talk about the distribution of the movie, and you said theatrical release. I'm curious if you did the traditional sort of outlets or also some other more organic ways.
Yeah, as far as distribution, we decided to self-distribute it. We raised additional capital to distribute. We hired a distribution consultant to go into different theaters. So far I think we've opened in 100 theaters nationwide, and we're just about to be on DVD, and then our TV date will be, I think it's in February of next year.
Have you found a way to show the film in Iraq to an Iraqi audience?
To show the film to an Iraqi audience, no. I don't think necessarily an Iraqi audience would necessarily be interested in American soldiers' perspective, so to speak. I mean, there's other Iraq docs that tell the Iraqi point of view. Hasn't been a big...
Have you been happy with the way the distribution system has worked? I mean, in terms of getting your message across to as many people as you can, whatever you think that message is, telling the story of the soldiers, do you think that the current way that you've gone about distributing it has been effective?
It's been the only way. I mean, the distribution and film distribution, especially theatrical, you know, it's by and large owned by the studios. So the way, if you're not a studio film and you're an independent film, the normal route is you apply to film festivals, you try to get into the biggest festival you can, you try to win. I mean, we were lucky, we got to Tribeca, we won Tribeca. But even at that point, you're looking at a 5-month lag time between when you're bought and when you roll out, and we wanted to get out earlier than that. And a lot of the deals these days, especially with the landscape changing, primary revenue streams are more in DVD sales and to a degree download sales. You don't necessarily want to give that away. So for us, our decision to do it self on our own was to try to, you know, have it be a better deal for us. So far it's been okay.
So,
but it's got to be one of the weirdest businesses where the riskiest money in, you know, the filmmakers, right, it's the last money out. And that's, I think, where you're seeing a lot of different people trying different models, you know, like Mark Cuban, you know, HDNet Films and Landmark Theaters, that whole, like, Steven Soderbergh, you know, when they did Bubble, they released theatrically on TV and DVD. The landscape is changing, and people are sort of finagling with different models trying to find what works, because it is a difficult system. And to try to recoup your costs.
So you guys had costs, outstanding costs that you needed to recoup through the distribution.
To make a film costs a lot of money.
Yeah, I guess I had thought that you had some advance funding for these cameras and stuff. I didn't know.
Equity. We raise money through investors.
So you raise the money through the investors, and then it's the,
and they want
the model
a return on their
and
investment.
Are putting it out. Just wanted to make sure that I understood how the film
they want
had
a return
made.
On their investment. I mean, there's different ways. I mean, some filmmakers raise money through foundations, you know, other things. I mean, when we started, the executive producer and I put our credit cards together to buy the cameras, and over time we then met other people, and then, you know, in the end got the investors that we needed. But when people invest in your film, they would like to see the money back. It's a business, the same as anything else.
Deborah, what would you say you've done if you abstract up a level? That is, can you describe your enterprise in a way where Iraq and soldiers would be fill in the blanks, but there's a structure to what you did and what you produced?
Yeah, I think it's a new model of filmmaking in the sense that it takes one form of traditional documentary filmmaking, which is probably the cinema verite or the observational, which is, you know, the fly on the wall of you record what happens, but put in the hands of those who you're following. So they're the ones that mounted the camera. So in a way, it's this integrative filming process where there's the traditional stuff where I did sit-down interviews with them and filmed a lot of them and their families, but they also filmed a portion of it. And the internet was, you know, a huge factor in that. Like, there's a scene that there's a double car bombing outside Taji, which Steve Pink had captured, and he had sent me an email telling me about it, and I saw one of my IM windows that Mike Moriarty was inside the wire, so I pinged him, and he was able to go get what's in the military an after action, a hot wash. So it was an immediate interview, which you would almost never get, and then following up later and later. But it is this hybrid way of making films, and I don't know what the exact terms are, but it is this combination of whether it's user-generated combined with traditional way of telling a story. You know, but it really was what having it unfold. I mean, I had no idea what would happen, and, you know, I would get IMs or emails telling me, and I would know what was in the pipeline, and we would wait and see what it was, and then based on that and how it resonated, when they were home, I would do more in-depth interviews with them, or through stories they had told me on IM conversations, even when the cameras weren't out, that then I would sit down and do an interview with them. So it really was, from my perspective anyway, crawling inside their experience to try to understand it, to then help tell it.
So you really were directing through the internet. You were in touch, IM and email.
Direct, I mean, yeah. I mean,
in an ongoing way, and
yeah,
kind of like a news director almost.
In the sense that I never said to them, go, like, that graveyard scene that you see, the burned out trucks that Mike Moriarty did. Mike Moriarty, that's on a special, KBR runs that yard on Anaconda, and he had told me about it. They saw the 1,007th casualty happen to a unit that was stationed right next to them. And they brought the vehicle after they had gotten the bodies out to that yard, and Mike had seen it, and it really bothered him. And I said to him, you know, it's something that we need to see is restricted access. Like, there's no way, if I were there, that I would have gotten onto that yard. I said, if you really think it's something we need to see, then you need to go do it. So I directed it in that sense, but not in a sense of saying, because there's a whole scene in the film where they rant about KBR. I never once said to them, go get me some stuff on KBR. So I like to be really careful of how that word is used, you know, because I worked with them to make sure that we would get the best story. And in that sense, yes. And was I super prepared for my interviews with all the questions? Did I go over all my IMs and email conversations with them before I sat down to know what story points to talk to them about? Absolutely. But did I try to say to them, oh, Zach, can you have running commentary about how you voted for Kerry, not Bush? No.
So just suppose that you were going to do something like what you did with a class of Harvard Law students about their law school experience. And you're going to somehow put tools in their hands, recording tools, video, audio, recording tools. And somehow you're looking for something at the end that integrates and becomes an aggregated product. What advice would you give? What have you learned from the enterprise that you did about how you would undertake such an enterprise?
Well, I think the power of the film, and the reason I'm a filmmaker, is I think that it allows people to walk a proverbial mile in someone else's shoes for that hour and a half or 2 hours. That's why I'm compelled to tell stories. So for Harvard Law students who are maybe looking at film or telling stories, you know, I think it all springs from passion and commitment. So I would say, for those of you who are interested in trying to tell a story, who are passionate about a point that you're, you know, that you want to talk about, that you want to get, I'm so glad somebody else does it. Thank you. It's normally me. It's all right. It's no problem. It really normally is me, so I am secretly happy. It's about if for somebody who's not used to being a filmmaker or for and wanting to get them in. Like if I were to say to you, because I don't really know so much of what the different stories you are. If I were to come in front of you like I did the guys, okay, let's just say, what I would say to you is, okay, I want to help you tell your story. Okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to talk. We're going to build a relationship. We're going to build a friendship. I'm willing to answer any question, you know, you ask me. You can ask me anything you want. I'm going to ask you the same. And it's not that I'm looking to expose anything or get dirt on you, but it's really so we understand each other, so we build a level of trust. Then, based on that, you tell me what you want to tell. You tell me what's important to you, what makes you... For me, what I find so compelling about this is what did the soldiers press record? For me, I found that really profound. What is it that made them press record? And a lot of them were really funny. They're like, oh, you know, I had to turn my GPS. You know, it's just the same as turning your computer on. They did a lot, just press record. But other stuff they went out and got, like that graveyard scene. Mike Moriarty went out and got that because he felt it was really important. So that is what I would say to you guys is what are you working on? Is it a case? Is it a law? What is it that you feel the world just does not get? What's hidden from view? What do you think is important? What do you know? Then you tell me. You know, and plus, like what I would do with the guys, I've got about 10 pages of questions that start at childhood that I go back through with everybody to try to get to know them. So let's say of your group, maybe five of you decided, yeah, you know, there's some story that I really want to tell. Then we sit down, I get to know you, you get to know me, you tell me, you know, what you're thinking your experience is going to be like. I mean, for these guys, before they left for Iraq, they didn't know if they were going to get over there and nothing would happen. But they were intrigued about trying to share their experience. I mean, as the guys got on the plane, you know, I hugged a bunch of them, and one of them said, you know, please don't let us die anonymous. And for them, that was one of their motivating factors. You know, they wanted it recorded. So I guess for you guys, it would be what story, you know, what in your life matters to you that you don't think people know about? And I think film's a great way to tell the story.
How important to that process do you think was the fact that that there was a dynamic of them telling their story and you telling their story? Like, this wasn't just produced by soldiers in Iraq. It was produced by you and soldiers in Iraq telling their story. And, you know, so, for instance, to continue this sort of metaphor, if someone were going to do that about students at Harvard Law School, mm-hmm. for some reason, you know, do you think it would be better if students at Harvard Law School did it? Or if somebody else in your position said, I'm going to help students at Harvard Law School sort of tell their story? How does that dynamic
I mean, for help? Me, working on other projects, yeah, I think that's an integral part. I mean, of how it happened, as far as people who have a story to tell, working with a filmmaker in this model to tell, I think makes a better story. It makes a better film. But I probably would say that because I just made a film that way and I like it. So, you know, I don't know. But I mean, based on, you know, I have looked at some citizen journalism and some other stuff, and I think very often what's lacking is context and story structure. So I think that in that melding, I think, can tell a better story. Does it have to be that way? No, but I'm a big fan of it.
So at another level, I'm very curious about how this works from a military point of view. That is, the picture that one can see between an open and a closed world has the open internet on one side of it mm-hmm. and the secret military planner, in a sense, on the other, where secrecy and control of the rhetorical environment and control of the information space and having better information than the other, the opposition, all of that is a huge part of military thinking. And here you're on this kind of interface in time where it's possible to give soldiers, it's maybe impossible not to give soldiers at this point access to the net access to an open environment, access to digital tools to record things and video things. And what can you tell us about how the thinking inside the military that is controlling, trying to control its environment, relates to a project like yours, which is actually aggressively putting the tools in their hand and putting the product up? And somehow it must go through a filter, and there must be a thought process that allows this to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I can only say, you know, for me, I went through the National Guard. It wasn't big army. It was the New Hampshire National Guard. And when I had the idea to give the soldiers the cameras and work with them over the internet, and I called the major back, the public affairs officer, with the idea, you know, he asked me, he said, do you really think this is a better way to tell the story? And I said, yeah, I do. You know, I really, really do. And he knew me from an earlier film I had made, so we had a relationship. And he went to the TAG, to the Adjutant General, and went to bat and said, look, she wants to do it this way. I think we should. And, you know, I got approval. And I can only say from my experience, you know, with the military, and they want the story told. They want the soldier's story told. I didn't have one instance of it not being that. I mean, the footage at Fallujah that they kept, there's a variety of reasons they could have kept that footage. I don't have an issue that they kept that footage. The story was still told.
So at what point in the process did they see the footage?
Yeah, they could watch everything.
They watched it before it got sent to you or something like that?
The option to review, always. Yeah.
So one thing I feel like I'm hearing that I kind of thought myself is that maybe there's a little bit of incompatibility between the kind of law school advocacy that we have as our role and the integrity of storytelling that you prize. You've made it really clear this is not about my policy views. This is not about an argument I'm trying to make. I'm not trying to persuade anyone for or against these things. And that allows the stories and the narrative to really shine through. For us, the situation is reversed, just about always, because this is law school. So it's all about the change we want to make, the policy we want to back, the argument we want to make, persuading people over to our side. And that seems to me fundamentally to sort of run up against or undercut the integrity of the stories that we're telling, because people will always know that underneath this story is really just me trying to get things to be my way. And the story almost becomes just a device instead of something that's really worth appreciating on its own. And you lose a lot of freedom that way. I want to know if I'm misunderstanding.
No, I actually have two responses to you, which is I actually am incredibly passionate about telling soldiers' stories and about getting people to actually care about soldiers. I mean, how many people... I know the answer to one person in here, but how many people in this room are friends with the soldier? And by that I mean correspond with them, you know, really know them, not see them maybe once every 5 years. Okay. Well, the statistic is less than a half a percent in the U.S. actually these days knows a soldier on any level whatsoever. For me, my mission, my advocacy was to try to bridge that gap. I'm from a blue-collar town. I ski-raced my way out. I got to an Ivy League school. I made my way to New York. These guys are my neighbors, and they are dying in our name. And so for me, that's my cause, you know. And a lot of times people want to know, are the pro or anti? They want me in that binary thing. And for me, I'm pro-soldier, so I step outside that. So one way when you're looking at some of those questions is to make sure, like so often I think it's that binary function that we get caught up in storytelling, this side and that side, which is why I like those multi-perspectives. Sorry. And I think you absolutely can be an advocate and want to tell a story. I don't have an ethical issue with that at all. I mean, I don't believe in objectivity, which I know, you know, will freak all sorts of people out. But I don't believe... I think you're a sum of all your life's experiences, and you come to stuff with who you are. And part of who you are is what story you want to tell. So I wouldn't let that stop you.
Well, but I mean, like, when you have, like, a Michael Moore-style documentary where you know what he's trying to do is make people stop the war, then whatever whoever's perspective he picks or whatever story he tells,
it's
you're already kind
that.
Of removed.
Right, of course. Right, but for, yeah.
So we have to take a break for the tape, and I'd like to take this opportunity to ask you all to thank Deborah for coming and talking to us, and thank you myself. Thank you very much, Deborah.
It's
extremely important.
I was thinking, I dream of Jeannie, you know.
All right, let's start with the question we ended with, which is, how can people get access to this film when it's available?
We have a website, thewartapes.com, where you can sign up for updates. But from what I understand, we're taking pre-orders for the DVDs. The DVD will be out in a few weeks. It's still in a few theaters. If you go on our website under screenings, it's still screening in a few theaters. thewartapes.com, all one word.
Yeah, I'm wondering how different was the pre-production process of this movie to other movies, like more conventional?
The pre-production for this movie was fast because I got the phone call with the offer and they were leaving in less than a month. Normally when you do pre-pro, you have more time to plan. So this was a total, you know, rush. But we were lucky in that, you know, I was able to go down and spend some time with the guys and do interviews. So you always want more time. It just doesn't always work out that way. And in the end, it was fine.
What are you working on next?
I'm working on two projects that I'm really not talking about yet. But the same paradigm, the same structure.
I wanted to ask you, how do you suppose the camera becomes sort of a character in the experience? And does it matter that here it's character-generated footage versus perhaps a third-party observer?
Yeah. In film school, the term is the corrupting influence of the camera, and how does that affect what people do? I think we were lucky in the fact that the guys had it for a year. They got it's just a small handheld thing, so... What they all said was by the end they didn't care. I mean, at the beginning they were, you know, mugging it up and sort of being silly and that kind of stuff. But over time it just was on there like another piece of equipment, like they say. You know, they would just turn this on, that on, and that on. They were ingenious, the two mounts I talked about, the dashboard of the Humvee and the gun turret, because it was hands-free. I mean, for them they were always soldiers. And just to be clear, you know, the guys are adamant that they were soldiers. They are not filmmakers. They do not want to be referred to as filmmakers. They absolutely hate that. And a lot of people want to make them into that. They have no interest in it whatsoever. They press record, they do some interviews, and that's what they see as their role in it. But they said over time they just didn't matter. You know, half the time they weren't paying attention if it was rolling or not rolling. So I think we got pretty close to it not being a corrupting influence. Plus, there were no bodies. You know, there wasn't me and a camera guy in there, too.
You mentioned sort of earlier, you talked about distribution mechanisms and funding and how your investors want to return on their investment. And then you also just talked about how you are in two projects of a similar vein that you're not yet talking about. So just sort of tying all that together, you know, has this distribution mechanism that you found here, is it financially feasible? I mean, obviously you're sort of not all the way through there yet. But I mean, does this seem like something that might be financially feasible? Obviously, I think if you've got more projects, then you at least have some hope that that this sort of production mechanism, which is sort of outside the traditional, is something that is ultimately... sustainable.
Most filmmakers are, you know, we're all sort of sorry sods and that we're compelled to tell stories. So one way or the other, there's always a willing credit card to get off and going on another thing. I mean, until you hit major DVD sales, you're not getting money normally, unless you're a surprise smash at the box office, which most films, independent films, aren't.
Are you yourself using the net to promote the film?
For example, I can imagine some little cut out of this
would be
hot on YouTube.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we've been on, like, iFilm has Warzone. Yeah, we were number one on Warzone. iFilm. We have a few different partners. Military.com is a big fan of the project. And we've been really lucky. I mean, if you look on Rotten Tomatoes, which is the site that aggregates, you know, reviews, we're at like a 98%. We got one bad review, so we've been very lucky as far as press goes.
You got a bad review?
Village Voice. They called us the cinematic equivalent to a yellow magnetic ribbon.
The cinematic
equivalent to a yellow magnetic ribbon.
Ribbon.
It's all right.
Is that the same paper that fired Nick Sylvester? Is it?
If you go on Rotten Tomatoes, that's our one splat. You can see it. It's right up there on the right-hand side.
One of the things I am curious about is whether you make any of the other raw materials available for people to look at, the stuff that didn't actually make it into the movie, or the IMs and things like that.
There's talk. When we do, the DVD that's coming out in 3 weeks is just the film itself. Then in March, we're going to do a big DVD release with extras and possibly a second DVD.
Like the making of the film.
Yeah, and some other stories that weren't included on the DVD, so more than just the making of the film, but some stories that didn't make it onto the film. And what's really difficult about making a film is that these days most features have to be between 90 minutes to 2 hours. That's just what you need it to be. So as heart-wrenching as it is to make a shorter movie, you know, believe me, I'd love a 100-hour movie. Remember, any of you guys did film school? You'd go and sit there like Piero Paolo Pasolini did that one movie, 2 hours. It was one 360-degree pan. He made a whole movie on that. I remember sitting through that thing. Anyway.
And you sat and watched the entire thing.
I did. I was in film school. I thought maybe something, I figured maybe in one frame they're going to do something, and if I miss it, I'm going to fail. Yeah, I suffered through it. So, but as far as other stuff, no. I mean, when you have your material, you have to, it's an asset. When you do it, it's an asset of the corporation, which is the movie. So it's not like it's going to be open source. What? That's funny, I guess.
No, I was just last week we were talking about empathic argument, which is a main subject for us here. And I gave a somewhat lame attempt at an empathic argument to John Stewart, who was asked to comment on the fact that they're taking down all of the Comedy Central stuff off YouTube at this point, pending the deal. And he was quoted back in 2005 as saying, "Look, I know how the game works. If they don't make their money, I don't get to do my show."
Right.
And I understand that is a definite reality.
Oh, yeah, no, someone posted our whole film on YouTube, and we promptly filed a cease and desist to have them take it off. Absolutely. And on Yahoo Video and Google Video, yeah, no, it's been out there. Yeah. And the attorney sent the letter right away.
Right.
I think it's still available.
Send me links, because we go after them. I mean, I understand it on the one hand, but I can tell you on the other hand, if you, as an artist, you know, because I've gotten asked also, like, well, you know, are you making money off of it? No, not yet. But, you know, I have to make a living too. And artists, if you want art generated and content generated and made, they have to find a way to sustain themselves.
Okay, David, if it's okay with you, I'd like to call this to a quit.
Thank you.
We've got a few more minutes to do a little bit more business.
Yep.
And thank you a ton for coming.
Put this on.
Oh, okay.
Deborah, you should feel free to stay if you like.
Well, one of the things I wanted to do today was to do a feedback memo and get back in touch with you again. So Can I just pass out stuff? And it's same old, in the sense of big thought, worry, concern. Say whatever it is you want to say directly to us. Sign it or not as you please. And if you want it not to be shared, nice big letters, do not share. And I would love it if Tim and Dean were included. Love you to hear, have your feedback. Guests included as well. Even guests sitting silently in the back, almost invisible. I also wanted to say that I've been this last week seeing numbers of you in my office, and it's such a positive experience for me. I totally encourage those of you who haven't come to come. It's just a great experience, for me at least, to get into what you're doing and to get to know you better. It's a big plus. Yes?
Should we email your assistant?
Yes, M. Harding. She schedules. And I want to ask you a question. 2.5-minute podcasts. How many do you feel that you would be comfortable listening to? That is, at what point would you imagine it to be painful to listen to more? How many?
Would that be in a continuous way?
Yes, over a period of time.
Over a period of time or sitting down and listening to them all at once?
I'll tell you what I'm trying to think about. I'm trying to think about how we could organize ourselves to act like an aggregator, to be an aggregator, a kind of, I don't know, we see reality television right now is full of aggregation schemes. American Idol is one, The Big Loser is one, all of these reality shows that come down to something. They're all winnowing, sorting, trying not to leave everybody out and keep everybody involved, but yet come to something at the end. And it seems to me that somehow this is going to involve a process in which we listen to each other's stuff and we make some kinds of choices that somehow push things along, both in terms of giving critique and of filtering up. So I'm actually toying in my mind with some scheme where each of you listen to a certain small number and say which ones. So for example, if you were going to listen to 5 and you were to say plus on 4 and there's one that you would drop, Big Loser fashion, if you were then able to write a critique that was empathic to the person whom you're suggesting the drop, in the same way that you will have to critique people who write memos for you and briefs for you and students who do papers for you, where the name of the game is first to say what's good about it, what the plus is, and then say where you think it could be improved. It's not a question of a judgment or a grade. It's what's the plus, where could it be improved? That then gives a critique to someone that they could use if they wanted to do another version or go through another edit or do something. And so some process that at once generates what we like and generates critique is what I'm trying to think through. And part of the thought process is, well, how much would you be willing to do? What are the units in which you try and scale something like that?
phrase big loser, that if you're a person who happens not to have a daughter who watches weird competitive weight loss reality television, you might not know what this is. But it's just a name for a reality TV show where they eliminate one person each week, not meaning to imply that the person who gets eliminated is a loser or something like that in some big, bad way.
Yes, this is a weight loss program where the winner is the biggest loser. That's the idea, the person who loses the most weight. And they have teams losing weight together, and then they eliminate people as they go along. Yes, so you're right. It has to do with a daughter who is fixated on weight loss problems. No, I'm sorry.
All right, that's not fair either. Anyway, the question is, how many could you listen to if you had a week? Would you listen to 5? Would you listen to 10 of these 2.5-minute things that made by your fellow students?
How many would stop at 1? How many would how many would stop at 3? How many would stop at 5? How many would stop at 7? All right, that's very informative. If you have ideas, I would love ideas. I've come increasingly to feel that what I said at the outset of the class last week, I didn't in a way realize how true it was until I watched the video of it myself and heard myself speaking. The idea of this class is for me the closest I have ever come personally to teaching what I'm learning. It's like, I know I don't know it, but I know it's there to be learned, and I've come to feel, in reading, mostly reading your projects and relating to you, that this is definitely a we enterprise. We are learning how to make empathic argument, and we are learning how to express argument out into this integrated media space. And it's clear to me from what we've done that the expression of argument out into media space has a tremendous amount to do with the aggregation function. Otherwise, it's just distributed chaff. And so the idea of us actually thinking in terms of an architecture for aggregation seems to me increasingly part of the substance of what we're thinking about doing and the way we're thinking about the doing of it. So if you have thoughts, ideas about how we can structure an aggregating mechanism that will work for us in the sense of not stifling creativity, leading people to cogent critiques and a feeling of willingness to respond to cogent critique, and at the same time filtering up to the top the stuff that we really want to look at if we only had 5 to look at, that's a challenge. So, all right, subject to finishing feedback memos, class dismissed.